always good to start off the day with a little Clash. I'm so bored with the USA. I don't know, it seemed like an appropriate song to talk about America, the Farewell Tour. Mr. Chris Hedges' latest book, who's with us on the phone. We'll talk to him momentarily. He's at a hotel in the Bay Area somewhere, I believe. He's a journalist, now a Presbyterian minister for some years, and a visiting Princeton University lecturer. Although, I don't know, this is Wikipedia. He's got a update, whatever I might have wrong. His books include War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, a finalist for the National Book Critics Award for nonfiction, Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy and the Triumph of the Spectacle, Death of the Liberal Class, an excellent book I read, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, written with a local Portland cartoonist Joe Sacco, which was a New York Times bestseller. He's also a columnist for the progressive news and commentary website Truthdig. And he worked for 15 years as a foreign correspondent for the New York Times. He was based in the Middle East for 5 years, serving for 4 of those years as the Middle East bureau chief. And so much more we could say. He brought in 2012, after the Obama administration signed the National Defense Authorization Act, or NDAA, he sued members of the U.S. government, claiming that Section 102.1 of the law unconstitutionally allowed presidential authority for indefinite detention without habeas corpus. And as I said, I could go on. He appeared last year, KBOO sponsored an event here in Portland with him. You've heard him many times. Good morning, Chris Hedges.
Hello, how are you?
I'm pretty well. Yourself?
I'm good. I'm in San Francisco.
Okay. Good. I always like to know where I'm talking to people. Whenever I call someone on a cell phone, even, I ask them, first off, where are you? I don't know why.
I am on 4th and Market at the Hotel Zelos.
I'm not sure we needed that specific. Anyway, so you've got a new book out. You're nothing if not prolific. I guess in these times, we've got to devote as much energies as we can to continuing to tell the truth. Tell us what made you write this particular book.
Well, I wanted to examine the pathologies that arise within any decaying culture. This comes out of Durkheim, Emile Durkheim's understanding that when cultures are in distress, it affects the way citizens or the population of that culture reacts and will propel those pushed aside, with the social bonds that are broken, the state of what Durkheim calls anomy. It will propel them towards behaviors that are deeply self-destructive. And that was the starting point for the book. So I spent time with heroin addicts, white hate groups. I reported out of San Francisco, out of kink.com. This is the largest BDSM operation probably in the world. They had bought the old National Guard armory down in the Mission District and live streamed events, and I took classes down there and interviewed people who worked there and people who had worked there. I wrote about gambling, and actually wrote that chapter out of the old Trump Taj Mahal before it closed and before Trump announced he was going to run for president. It was just kind of serendipitous. And really wanted to expose the human cost of a society that's disintegrating and how in a sick society these pathologies express themselves. So with the core understanding being that until we address this massive social inequality, political paralysis, alienation, despair, things will continue to decline. These kinds of behaviors will continue to expand. And it has almost nothing to do with the personality of Donald Trump, who is a symptom of a decayed society rather than the disease, an expression of a decayed society. And you go back, I studied classics at Harvard, and it there are many similarities to the end of the Roman Empire, but to the end of any empire, if you read the writings of Stefan Zweig or Joseph Roth or even Freud with the old Austro-Hungarian Empire. So that was the focus of the book.
Yeah, you even said, I believe, that this society vomited up. It was almost inevitable that it would vomit up a figure like Donald Trump. You have you talk a lot about a couple key ideas, terms are denial and magical thinking. You've talked in many of your books about the here, let me just read a little quote. You have such powerful prose, if I do may say so. Miller captures in the play.
The championship season.
The championship season, yeah, because you focus in your first chapter, Decay, a lot on Scranton, Pennsylvania, as being emblematic of the decay and the way the empire is crumbling. So let me just read this paragraph. Miller captures in the play the darkest pathology of white America, the inability to accept who we are, where we came from, acknowledge and take responsibility for the crimes we committed, and with that understanding, access where we are going and who we want to become. The danger of self-delusion is a central point of Miller's play. I actually hadn't seen that play, and it's very powerful. We'll talk a little bit more about that.
Well, it's a portrait. So you're right. I opened the book writing out of Scranton, Pennsylvania, which is one of innumerable deindustrialized pockets in the United States. But when I'm there, the city is facing insolvency, and they're desperately trying to raise funds to pay city employees, and they're doing that by selling off city assets, utilities, the sewer system, the parking authority, and of course this is terminal. There reaches a point when municipalities don't have any more assets to sell. These corporations jack up the prices. Scranton is a very depressed community. It was, I think, one point had the fourth highest per capita income in the country. It's one of these deindustrialized wastelands with all of the attendant despair and physical and psychological breakdown that comes with this kind of decay. And Miller wrote this play, The Championship Season, which really explores that extinguishing or exposure of the myth of the American dream. And part of it is that undercurrent of our inability as white Americans to deal with the true behavior and history of our relationship, in particular to African Americans, also Native Americans, and the nature of empire, the nature of imperialism. So, and the failure to have an honest reckoning of who we are and where we came from becomes in the hands of the power elite, you know, ultimately a basis for an eradication of the ability to be not only self-critical but self-aware. And in moments of distress, this feeds into the hands of demagogues like Trump or people who peddle magical thinking like the Christian right. And I had written a book 10 years ago on the Christian right called American Fascist, The Christian Right and the War on America, and I did not use the word fascist lightly. As you point out, I am a seminary graduate and am actually a Presbyterian minister. So that's what happens when people cannot cope with the reality around them. They retreat into what anthropologists call crisis cults. That's what the Lakota and other Native communities did in 1890 at Wounded Knee with a ghost dance, where they would don shirts that would protect them from the colonizers' bullets, and that they would engage in this Sufi-like dance that would bring back the buffalo herds, and the warriors who had been killed in the genocide would rise up out of the earth, and the white colonizers, Euro-Americans and Americans, would disappear. So that's a characteristic of a society in decline. Norman Cohen wrote a good book about it, on millennialism in the 15th century in Europe. So and we are barreling towards that. The eradication of civil discourse based on verifiable fact, the retreat into a world of collective self-delusion, and this is also just characteristic of a society that can't face the bleakness before it. We haven't even spoken about climate change, and I was down at the climate resistance encampment here in San Francisco yesterday afternoon. And of course, that only accelerates the collapse. It accelerates the decline. We have no discussion, because commercial interests rule most of the airwaves. We have no national discussion of the very nature of capitalism, and in particular global capitalism, that is pushing us towards another financial crash, which will be worse than 2008, because they don't have a plan B. They can't lower interest rates any more than they've already lowered them, which is virtually zero. They created, according to the University of Missouri researchers, some $26 trillion out of electronic ether, handed it to banks, who have used it to buy back their own stock and swell their compensation packages, along with the money saved from the tax cuts, hoard it, pay the interest on unsustainable debt. And the New York Times ran a story the other day about how the fracking industry may be the next dot-com crash, because investments are made on projected profits. The fracking industry is actually a huge money-losing venture. And then, of course, the debt peonage, because it has to be paid back. So what do? They extract it out of a population that is already in economic under severe economic stress, and that's student loan, $1.5 trillion. And it's estimated that within another decade or so, 40%, there'll be 40% default. The fracking industry, as I mentioned, could collapse. And you have personal household debt, there was 13-some trillion dollars. You're late on your credit card, it jumps to 28%. The stagnation and decline of wages, coupled with increasing prices just to survive. We talked about the privatization of utilities, but also medical costs, which are soaring, even if you have insurance. So, yeah, we're all kind of headed for a tsunami, and we live at the moment in a period of relative stability. What I fear is that should the system crack and that stability be broken, then the monsters will really come out, as I witnessed in the former Yugoslavia with the economic meltdown of Yugoslavia, which triggered the civil war in Yugoslavia and gave rise to figures like Radovan Karadzic and Slobodan Milosevic and Franjo Tuđman.
Let's hold off on that for a second. As I told you, we are in our membership drive, so we'll be taking a few breaks here to remind people how to keep at least this forum for a discussion of capitalism and other crucial issues facing us. And remind you to call 877-500-5266. We'll be back with Chris in just a few minutes to continue to talk about his new book, America, The Farewell Tour, just out from Simon & Schuster. And we have him live on the phone from his hotel room in San Francisco. I'm Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio, and I'm on the phone live with author Chris Hedges on the phone from his hotel room in San Francisco. Yes, and please do give us a call and support Talk Radio, support this program, support the work of Chris Hedges, also by giving us $80 and getting a copy of his new book. And I don't want to hog this conversation with Chris Hedges, so let's just go to a caller who's got a question. Sean, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning, Mr. Hedges. You know, I was wondering what it would be like to be a high school student graduating this year. I was wondering if you could comment on the pressures that young people are facing, because it seems like we have a kind of default setting where if we're not going to enforce labor laws and we're not going to allow for unionization, kids are almost forced onto this path of becoming highly educated professionals. And Thomas Frank, in his book, Listen Liberal, and you in Death of the Liberal Class, it seems like both of you kind of outline how, like, in a certain way, young people are forced down this ultra-conservative path of becoming highly paid, highly educated professionals. Thanks.
Well, it's a good point, because we don't remunerate in any meaningful way anything but subservience to corporations and corporate power. And we've seen a transformation of our educational system into one that focuses on vocational training at every level. So, for example, if you go into an inner city school, which is substandard, you give your students, mostly poor people of color, enough numerical literacy to work at behind a fast food counter at a Walmart. If you go to Princeton, where I have taught, you are training systems managers. The largest major at Princeton, as is also true at Harvard, is computer science. And these people start auditioning to go to these well-compensated jobs on Wall Street from the first week they arrive at the university. I will see them, these young men and women, even before classes start, going off in tuxedos and ball gowns to the eating clubs, which are hierarchical. One seeks to be admitted, and you're selected, and the selection basis is kind of opaque. It's, are you one of us? So you're selected at one of these exclusive eating clubs like Ivy, and then it's quite an open understanding that, for instance, Goldman Sachs recruits out of Ivy. So all the way up and down, we have created these systems managers at various levels. If you seek, as you correctly point out, to step outside the system, for instance, if you want to be a public school teacher, then your salary is substandard. There is a war on your union. How many teachers in this country have second jobs? How many teachers in this country, out of their own money, buy school supplies because of school budgets that are inadequate in supplying the most basic needs of our children, including things like toilet paper? So if you want to do journalism, you either serve the corporate echo chamber by finding a job within corporate media, CNN, MSNBC, but if you seek to focus on something other than the kind of court gossip that dominates now what masquerades for news, you're shuttled often to a website where you're not paid at all. There's a kind of war in any totalitarian society, and we live in a species of corporate totalitarianism, against anything that has to do with beauty or truth that is transformative, that seeks to build and support community. And this is, I think, as you correctly point out, one of the most frightening distortions of American society, and why all of those disciplines which come out of the humanities, and of course the humanities are withering away within the universities. And then I just have to add at the end, one of the factors that propels so many college graduates into the arms of corporations is debt. The debt is so massive that they can't afford to take a job. I mean, for instance, if they graduate from law school and defend poor people.
Hey, Chris, so let's talk a little bit more about capitalism. You mentioned that there's a sort of a taboo or ban on any kind of national discussion on this. Of course, this has been some 100 years has been the case since, especially since, you know, before McCarthyism, since, you know, post-World War I, the kind of destruction of the real more radical labor movement, which actually did talk about the capitalist system. You're at this, you know, so it's, and let's talk about denial and magical thinking. In 2012, North Carolina banned the state from basing coastal policies on the latest scientific predictions of how much the sea level will rise, which is bitterly, tragically ironic since there's this massive killer storm bearing down on North Carolina. Obviously, reality is impinging upon our denial and our magical thinking. But it's easy to sort of, you know, look at these conservative elements that have control of state houses and the alt-right or whoever, and see them as being lost in this realm of denial. But, you know, you're at this Global Climate Action Summit. How much discussion of capitalism is there? I know there's been a discussion somewhat within the so-called climate movement, you know, whether it can, you know, can the climate issue be addressed within capitalism, or does it have to be done through capitalist mechanisms? Have you
The people protesting the climate summit are protesting for precisely that point. They argue that it can't be done within the system of capitalism, and they're right. And this summit is bringing together capitalists. Who whether it's carbon credits or whatever mechanism they're using, is seeking to build systems of profit off of the deterioration of the biosphere. And we live in such an impoverished state that somebody like Jerry Brown, who even acknowledges the reality of climate change, which is what the Paris conference did, for instance, is a kind of welcome relief from figures in the Trump administration who are climate deniers. And yet at the same time, the response is woefully inadequate to the emergency that is facing us. California is the fourth largest producer of oil in the country. It squanders immense amounts of water resources in the animal agriculture industry, and we are watching every climate change report that I read becomes more and more hysterical as climate scientists acknowledge that the acceleration of global warming, the melting of the polar ice caps, the acidification in the oceans is happening at a far faster rate than they predicted. And part of the reason that they have this cap that they keep using about 2% Celsius is that they know from studying weather conditions on planets such as Venus, which used to have a lot of water, that you can trigger these feedback loops where there's just nothing you can do to stop the destruction of the biosphere that makes human habitation possible. I mean, on Venus, I think it's 800 degrees or something. So this is the danger, and the response in the hands of corporatists, it's the primacy of profit. It's not the primacy of life. And so you have thousands of climate activists from all over the world. I was down with in the section of the park yesterday where all the indigenous activists were from Brazil and the South Pacific and native communities who are, of course, on the front line. They are the people who are affected first. It's to deal with the climate crisis within the rubric of capitalism is to push the human species closer and closer towards extinction.
But of course, the corporatist includes wide segments of people that we might ordinarily think of as our allies, which is obviously one of the contradictions that I think is really handicapped us for a long time. We remain trapped in the dynamic of not really wanting to confront these contradictions internal to whatever movement, environmental or whatever. But I want to ask you, so this national taboo, which certainly extends to national public radio, I never hear them talk about. I don't know why. I should maybe expect it even, but is that a disappointment of yours that they're, even in this era of them really seeming to step out, they've had Carl Bernstein on, is it Bernstein or Woodward with the new book?
It's Woodward.
Woodward, sorry. I grew up in Washington reading about Watergate, so those two names are linked in my brain. Anyway, so they do, seem to kind of go out on a limb sometimes more than they may have a couple years ago, really talking about the administration, but they still don't really talk openly about the nitty gritty realities of capitalism. What are some of your real disappointments, not just NPR, about the failure to really look directly and talk about the system, the actual system we live in?
Well, the first issue is that these corporate entities, Comcast, which owns MSNBC, and they have replaced journalism with info entertainment, and it's court gossip from inside our version of the Forbidden City. It's which mistress Louis XIV, the Sun King, takes into the bedchamber. It's endless speculation. It's interviews with porn actors and their lawyers who want to run for president, and former reality television stars like Omarosa, and Trump, of course, comes out of that world. Endless speculation about, meanwhile, the reality of 70%+ of the American public, which is really struggling, goes utterly unreported. They are rendered invisible. So that's my first problem. It's about revenue streams. They understand that this tawdry, salacious, celebrity-driven trivia is profitable, and CNN made more money than they ever made in their history last year. I think they made $1 billion off of this garbage. But it's not journalism. That's the first problem. The second problem, and you can talk about public broadcasting, is that its budget, its government contributions are so diminished as to be negligible, which means that they are reliant on corporate donors, including the Koch brothers, who are big contributors to both PBS and NPR. When I was in Boston a year or two ago, I found that David Koch sat on the board of the major Boston NPR station. And so they cannot afford to alienate these forces, and this is also true within academia, on which they depend for money.
Okay, hold
that. And so they shut out corporate critics. They have no serious discussion of the disastrous consequences of neoliberalism or global capitalism, whatever word you want to use, the seizure of power by this cabal of corporate interests that has rendered the citizen impotent. The voices, and these voices are vital for a society to examine itself. So if you went back to the 1960s and turned on PBS, you could see James Baldwin, Malcolm X, Noam Chomsky, who's been virtually our greatest intellectual blacklisted, Howard Zinn, not anymore. And that's why I have a show on RT called On Contact, where I interview these kinds of voices, Richard Wolff, a great economist. I did a show with Mumia Abu-Jamal, and et cetera, because that's the last readout. I'm no defender of Putin or the autocratic system in Russia, But there's nowhere else for us to go.
Except
and we're watching through Google, Facebook, and Twitter algorithms.
Okay, we gotta go back to our own, tooting our own horn as one place where we do get to hear you and many others here on KBOO Community Radio. 877-500-5266. Chris Hedges, I'm talking to live from San Francisco. America, the Farewell Tour is his new book. You can get a copy for a minimum of an $80 a year contribution. Of course, you can just make any amount of contribution by calling 877-500-5266. We've only got to 15 minutes left with Chris Hedges, and I appreciate your hanging on during those. I know you've done this a lot because, of course, community radio is one of the few outlets other than RT and perhaps Democracy Now and then. I don't know. We really appreciate your coming on with us. We appreciate the work you've done over all these years. We appreciate you last year. That was a great talk you gave, two of them actually, here in Portland. I just want to read another paragraph because, again, your prose is really powerful. You're really get deep into this. This is from your first chapter again. The end is too horrible to contemplate. The tangible signs of our demise may be obvious, but this only accelerates our retreat into the delusional thinking fostered by crisis cults. We will believe ever more fervently that the secular gods of science and technology will save us, or trust our fate to Jesus and biblical prophecies. This is in the context of a book about climate change called The Water Will Come, Rising Seas, Sinking Cities, and the Remaking of the Civilized World by Jeff Goodell. That's there's really cogent there that on the one hand, the belief in the secular gods of science and technology, and the other in either Jesus and biblical prophecies, or, you know, it could be Allah, it could be, I don't know, maybe even the Buddha. But talk about this idea, because, you know, that's a kind of denial and a magical thinking that we don't too much think about, this idea of this continuing touching belief in progress and science, that somehow maybe we don't even have to think that much about this whole issue of climate change because, you know, someone will figure it out.
Well, sure. I mean, it's the misguided notion that somehow we'll adapt, that technology will adapt to severe climate change. It is as delusional as the idea that Jesus will come down and lift us up in the rapture. It is in both cases.
Something just happened with the. There we go.
What is happening around us? The whole rise of human civilization is a very short and brief window of planetary history. It's only 10,000 years after the last ice age, when most of North America was buried under sheets of ice 8 times the height of the Empire State Building. So it's a tiny span in the 4.5 billion years of the planet has been around, known as the Holocene Age. And that's what we're doing, is we're destroying the peculiar climatery conditions, including, for instance, the Gulf Stream.
Hold on a second. Something's going on with the line. Is it on our end or your end? I'm not sure.
Oh, can you hear me now?
There you go. Okay.
Yeah, it's destroying that peculiar ecosystem that has made human civilization possible. And this is what, you know, when they talk about transitioning into the Anthropocene, they're talking about transitioning out of that ecological balance that has not only made human civilization possible, but made human existence possible. And that's the danger, that we're just not confronting the fragility of a planetary system that gives us life.
Line just messed up again.
So dangerous.
There we go. Okay. Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I've been sort of obsessively reading and focusing on that strange paradox, you know, that the very, anyway, this period, this remarkable period of warming after this ice age that allowed this flourishing is now, we've now jacked it up to a point where it may be gone forever. But we only have a few minutes left with you, and again, I'm speaking with Chris Hedges. America, the Farewell Tour is his latest book. There's the chapters are decay, heroin, sadism, hate, gambling, and freedom. And freedom, of course, is the longest one. Want to talk about the real briefly the last chapter of freedom?
Well, I think it's I think the most difficult existential crisis we face is to confront both how bleak the situation has become, how dangerous it has become, and yet react anyway. To remain passive is to be complicit in our own destruction. I think we also have to grasp that the ruling elites have captured all of the institutions, whether it's the Democratic Party, the courts, the press, and are not going to respond rationally to the crisis around us. They are driven by this mania for short-term profit at the expense of life itself. And we have to rebuild the kind of popular movements such as is happening today in San Francisco with frontline communities that have come to challenge the idea that capitalism can somehow solve the assault on the ecosystem. We have to pit power against power, which means organizing and not putting our faith in any political figure at this point. We have to build, and this is, of course, the beauty of community radio, alternative systems of information so that we can ask the questions and carry out the discussions that are being locked out of the corporate-dominated mainstream media and a public broadcasting system that has been captured by corporate power. And we have to build alternative or parallel institutions that sever ourselves from the tentacles of corporations, which means local food, public banks, local currencies. The more we can cut ourselves off from the stranglehold of corporations, and of course, one of it is breaking free from the consumer society, the freer we'll become.
Listen, Chris, we're going to have to run here pretty quick and remind our listeners once again of the importance of supporting this particular station. But I'd like to kind of give you a chance, if you're up for it, give it your best shot of, you know, convincing people who are listening why this station, KBOO, which you have appeared on numerous times, like so many of our sister stations, why should they support KBOO right now in this particular moment?
Well, because voices like mine are being shut out. Voices like Chomsky's, Ralph Nader, Medea Benjamin, voices of the most important activist movements, Black Lives Matter. We have nowhere else to go, and as with the abolition of net neutrality and the imposition of algorithms directed at left-wing sites, we've already seen traffic plummet in terms of referrals. So if you type in imperialism, and if Black Agenda Report had written an article on imperialism a year and a half ago, it would come up with other articles, recent articles on imperialism. Not anymore. And so traffic has plummeted on Truthdig, Bob Scheer's great website out of L.A. that I write a column for every Monday. you have seen referrals from impressions decline from over 700,000 to below 200,000. And this is because the elites grasp that their ruling ideology of neoliberalism has lost all credibility across the political spectrum, and the response is now to shut out or even further marginalize the critics because they don't have a counterargument. And the only place in Portland you're probably, at least on the radio, going to hear that counterargument is cable.
Well, right on. Thank you for that. We're going to finish out the hour appealing to our listeners to heed the words of Chris Hedges. Thank you so much, Chris Hedges, author of America, The Farewell Tour, and so many other books. And we'll be speaking to you again in the future, I'm sure.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. And that is the great and powerful writer, Chris Hedges, who has, as I said, America, The Farewell Tour, his new book out, of which you can get a copy by going to 877-500-526 right now. Do it now. We have 5 minutes left to support, for today, talk radio. To support this program in particular, you do have only 5 minutes, and we really appreciate, I really appreciate your support. The station appreciates it, and we've got to keep going. We got to, like Chris Hedges says, we can't just roll over in the face of all of this madness and chaos. 877-500-5266.